the difference between public involvement and theater of public involvement became quite clear to me too, that it wasn't enough just to show up at my neighborhood association meetings, that we sort of had to build these movements from the ground up. Nobody was going to come and save us.
Welcome into Priced Out, the podcast. I'm Andrew Morgan, your host, right alongside Cornelius Swart. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing good. How are you feeling, though? You're looking a little sleepy here today.
I took NyQuil, like, not regular, like, the oats. It was green, you know, like, that is the nastiest stuff ever, but...
It's heavy duty.
I tried to sleep forever, but I have kids and responsibilities, so...
And you don't look like a heavy drinker to me.
No, I don't drink at all, period.
See, that's... I think you're particularly susceptible for that, yeah. NyQuil, as opposed to the guy who's, like, doing shots every night.
Yeah.
NyQuil's just another, yeah, just a walk in the park.
He literally has to, like, put it in an open wound in order for to get his blood.
Well, I'm glad that you've been able to stay conscious with us, because we have a very interesting interview coming up here with Meg Hansen, who is known throughout the activist, housing activist, social media world as Nerdletta, and she's a data activist. She is in tech for her professional career. She is a renter who doesn't believe in credit, so she does not own a home, and she has gone deep, deep, deep into the Portland zoning code in order to show a connection between displacement, demolitions, and historic preservation. It's a very interesting perspective. She talks a lot about Portland's new move to upzone the entire city. About 96% of the city will be upzoned under its current plans. And she is sort of the opposite end of an argument that says if you create more housing, the price for housing will go down. She is of the school that if you protect more housing, more affordable housing will be protected. And so we're ready to jump in. And this, she's the sort of the foil for Michael Anderson's interview that we did several months ago about zoning and upzoning.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, everybody. I'm here with Meg Hansen, who is a data activist and a historic preservation advocate here in Portland, Oregon. And we are going to talk about historic preservation and how it relates to gentrification and demolition of historic properties and affordable housing, as far as how Meg sees it. And so, Meg, you have a passion for this, for historic preservation. And what is historic preservation?
I think it's kind of a broad term. And I think that historic preservation in the past is kind of different than it is currently. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about historic preservation with a capital H, or we can talk about preservation in general. So I think
you're saying the difference is like the fixing up of old homes and sort of preserving, you know, very landmark buildings was sort of a different movement, mm-hmm. That people maybe understand or are familiar with more. And then you're talking about something a little bit different, which is to simply preserve a housing stock that is affordable.
Well, and also sort of the intersection of public versus private, the fabric of communities, what happens in a place, who lives there. So historic with a capital H, you know, tends to conjure images of people talking about corbels and fenestration and fancy stuff. But historic preservation as a tool, mm-hmm. has been used throughout history to sort of look ahead and say, this is part of this, it's in the public interest that we not let this be erased. Mm-hmm. And so there's always a balance between preservation and progress and what people deem to be historic by virtue of aesthetics versus what it means to a community. So it's a lot of things to a lot of different people. My emphasis is more on the human aspect of of the built environment and conservation.
Well, it's interesting because historic preservation has historically been part of the gentrification cycle in many cities. You know, the idea that people go in and start to fix up these old homes in these neighborhoods that are quote unquote neglected. Mm. This tends to be the first wave of new investment in these neighborhoods. And once these houses get fixed up, they become, you know, very unique properties.
Yeah.
And that attracts more money, and that attracts more people, and that, you know, gets the speculative kind of gentrification that's very damaging rolling.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think we all experience that as we grow older and we look around, where we have this sort of expansion and contraction and you know, waves of different sort of awful speculative development that tends to disinvest, to sort of starve communities of amenities, and also the difference between, you know, wealthier, whiter people flocking to the suburbs versus, you know, having a change of preference for urban communities where people already live. And I think that we see some different waves. So what you're talking about in terms of gentrification that is based on sort of fixer-uppers, mm-hmm. and people moving into communities and saying, well, I don't have a lot of money, but I can fix this up. I think fast forward to what we're dealing with now is sort of on the other side of that, where this isn't necessarily people buying fixers. We have large corporate gentrification on a scale which I think we even need a new name for it. I mean, it's still relevant in terms of colonization and finding places for the gentry to live. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing the difference between people moving in, fixing things up, and things popping up versus large corporate global real estate speculation taking out a giant eraser.
Okay, so we'll dive deeper into that in a few minutes. But taking a step back, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Salem, Oregon. I came to Portland in 2002 to live. But I, you know, Salem's not too far away, so it had always been the place that, as a kid, as a teenager especially, I escaped to.
And in Portland, where did you live?
I live in Sunnyside. And I got the crummiest place on the block, but I love, I feel really, really fortunate to live in a neighborhood like Sunnyside.
And you tell me that you're deliberately a renter? Like you've made that choice?
Well, I made that choice
not to be in debt.
I don't believe in credit personally. And so I have never had a credit card. You know, my life would look a lot different if I had credit. But I also, I do different things with the money that I do have when I do have it. And I don't work all of the time. What I do is, you know, steals my life. And so in between projects, very attached to money as survival, and especially growing up poor. I wouldn't say that I'm a renter by choice, but for me, it's by necessity, just because I also don't understand money and investment. So I figure I'm much better off just kind of going with what I know.
You are huge on social media. You're known as Nerdletta, but your presence on social media, I feel, is, and the way you use social media is part of your tech background.
I specialize in Oracle's enterprise resource planning suite. To call it large, massive, mm-hmm. is sort of an understatement.
Explain it to us, like, we're your grandma. What is it?
Well,
you
my
do?
Grandma says she works with computers. Bless her heart. So in a nutshell, I do global supply chain. I'm a global supply chain architect and engineer. So I deal with concepts and complexity on a global scale, but also engineer, reverse engineer and forward engineer on a very fine detailed level. And with these sorts of interactions, it's an exercise in complexity, a lot of due diligence and a lot of patience. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of my background. And I've been an independent for many decades. And so I have, and before going out on my own, I was a bureaucrat for 7.5 years. Then I went into private industry and then I forged out on my own.
And what does Oracle do?
Oh, it's a large software suite.
Right.
And there's a lot of other sort of appendages and standalone things. But what I deal with is the enterprise resource planning. And it's something that a lot of consumers don't, you know, if you're not in the industry, it's not something that people are necessarily, you know, they may be familiar with Oracle, but it's large, it's complex, it's a database that allows manufacturers to operate globally, and it has all of these different modules, if you will. So everything that makes up an enterprise.
What is the connection between demolitions and displacement and historic preservation?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, we live in a city that does not restrict demolitions whatsoever, unless it's subject to review in a historic district, which is about 3% of the city. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing where when we started following and tracking demolitions, which I started doing even before then, been doing that for about 5 years. And the low-hanging fruit were rental houses, investment properties where people lived. And when we have large waves of speculation, so the difference between homeowners coming in and saying, I want to buy that property, move into it, mm-hmm. we started to see escalations in renters being displaced by virtue of their landlords getting cash offers from developers. There were a lot of cash offers at that time. And mm-hmm. we watched that. So not only taking a look at demolitions, but also over on the tenant front, the rising number of people saying I've been evicted and they've sold the house and they're demolishing it. So displacement and demolition go hand in hand, particularly when we don't subject demolitions to review whatsoever, and a developer or corporate development can come in and demolish sound, habitable housing without having any responsibility to put back in terms of affordability and livability, more than they take away.
Now, so what you said is that because land became so valuable, it was rising, the values were rising so quickly,
yeah.
a speculator could come in, buy a property, easily demolish it, and because there were no meaningful restrictions on process of demolition, mm-hmm. they saw that as an opportunity mm-hmm. and quickly demolished. You also said that there was a loophole, which implies that there was an intent of government or law to do something.
Yes.
But if you knew the system, you could yeah. subvert that intent. What was that loophole?
It's a giant loophole, as a matter of fact. And it has to do with the historic resources inventory. So back in the 80s, they did an inventory, not just in Portland, but all across the United States. And it was part of, part of an Environmental Protection Act that said we have a duty to sort of inventory things that are non-renewable. What are our resources? So historic resource inventory was a list of properties that said these are things that are either architecturally or culturally, historically significant. And not just aesthetically, but there was also inventories that said, you know, here's what happened here. And in about two, and the law used to be that if you were going to take something off of that list, there was a 120-day delay. And that was an opportunity for the public to say, this is important. There was a balance between public and private ownership interests. The Historic Landmarks Commission at that time, if a developer wanted to demolish a property that was on the HRI, the Historic Landmarks Commission at that time could also pursue a public purchase. So private property rights did not reign supreme. And then in 1996, owner consent regulation came along, which said that can't designate anything as historic unless the property owner approves of it. And then in about 2002, what we saw was this quiet loophole that was created that even though the state law still demanded 120-day delay for HRI removals, they did a code, Portland City Code reorganization project, where they decoupled delisting from the delay. So the 120-day delay, not only that gave the property the public notice that this was happening, but was supposed to facilitate conversations that said, are there, and explore alternatives. So in 2002, they reorganized the code and decoupled the delay from the delisting quietly. And it wasn't until about, you know, maybe 4 years ago, when we had this, you know, sort of bubble expanding, that we started to notice that there were properties on the HRI that were getting same-day demolition permits.
Okay.
And then when we investigated, not only did I go in and say, well, here's the loophole. Here's
this
why. Right. But then traced back and went into the archives to say, what did the code look like in 1996, what did it look like in 2000? What did it look like in 2002? And that's where we saw this intentional break. And part—
So when they decoupled this, just to interrupt real quick, was that a public process? Was that a—
Absolutely not.
So there wasn't a lot of— and it wasn't a legislative process.
It was not.
Didn't go through city council.
It was not a legislative process because part of the reorganization says, well, unless you're changing the way things get enforced, it doesn't have to be a legislative process. But what it was surreptitious deregulation. And so for 13 years, almost 14 years, developers all of a sudden didn't have to wait. And recently that became even more magnified when we saw these HRI demolitions, because part of why they were sort of really juicy for developers was that a lot of them sit on double lots. And there's also a loophole called the lot confirmation. So if there are underlying, more than one underlying lot, tax lot on underneath a property, then developers can also circumvent a land use review. And they can get an administrative lot confirmation that says, okay, you now have two tax lots. They not only circumvent land use review, but they circumvent zoning. And so we saw developers looking for historic properties that sat on double lots, and a lot of them were HRI properties.
Okay, so let's—
It's a little complicated.
Yeah, let's back up a little bit. I'm just going to try to review what you said. So basically, there's a lot in 2015, you're seeing a lot of demolitions, right? And so what you saw was that there was a catalog of historic, or at least potentially historic, buildings all throughout Portland. And that catalog had been created in the 1980s. And if you were on that catalog, if your property was on that catalog, there was an additional level of public review, which would slow down the demolition project, would alert neighbors, and which if a community was averse to these demolitions, demolition of historic property, quote unquote historic. We want to make a distinction here between capital H historic,
capital H,
meaning it's legally recognized as historic and preserved, a property that is old and significant to many people, but is not official.
Right.
So this public review of these older homes was required, but the laws that implemented or enforce that review have been eroded over the years.
Absolutely.
And most importantly, one was by passing a new law, which is you don't like a law, you can pass your own.
Right.
If someone's trying to pass a law, you can fight it. It's fair. It's fair.
Right.
Right. But there was this other process that happened sort of in the bowels of the bureaucracy.
Yes.
Which was they through working the code, so to speak, mm-hmm. you know, literally and sort of like in your data work, yeah. they were working with the code and they removed, they kind of separated out the requirement for a public review
yeah.
for all of these sort of lesser historic properties.
Yeah.
And you went in and through your data mining abilities and investigative talents, you found that they had done this without notifying the public,
yep.
without going through city council or through a legislative process.
Mm-hmm.
And that enabled developers, when the market got really, really hot, to just smoke all these properties without an opportunity for the public to comment.
Absolutely.
And that's correct, right?
Absolutely. And part
of
that—
That's a heck of a lot of work on your part. Good job as someone who occasionally acts or pretends to act like a journalist. I know that's a lot of work.
It was a headache. Restore Oregon sort of brought that situation to public awareness. What I did also on the heels of that was I went in and I did a 5-year study. I went back and I said, okay, show me all of the properties that have been delisted. And then I went in and I traced through not only when the demolition permit was filed, but when it was demolished. And then I traced it through into subsequent sales. Mm-hmm. So we found it was developers who knew the system, and you see the same names mm-hmm. throughout there too. And mm-hmm. so they know how to work the system.
How many properties were delisted or delinked? Under this,
I don't recall. Well, in terms of from the time at which the loophole was created until they finally closed that loophole,
right?
They didn't. By the way, they didn't close the loophole until 2016, and that mm-hmm. was only after a long court battle that had to do with designation and delisting, formal designation. And it went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court mm-hmm. after some appeals. And then the city finally said, well, we're going to start enforcing this. They didn't admit that they had been breaking the law, mm-hmm. but it was sort of a tacit admission.
So you had to take, the activists had to take them, had to take the city to court to essentially get them to enforce their own rules.
To get them to comply with state law. And I went before city council twice, first to sort of bring my report that sort of gathered up some recent history of it, quantified it and qualified it and sharpened that stick to say, mm-hmm. I have tied this up into a nice, pretty package and put a bow on it.
Right.
And if somebody wanted to sue the city, which seems to be the only thing that the bureaucracy sort of responds to,
sure.
is when people or organizations come and say, we're going to threaten to sue. And that's how developers have sort of benefited from the creation of these loopholes. They threaten to sue all of the time. And so the city is so risk averse. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot more muscle to do it from the grassroots.
So let's talk a little bit at least about the numbers or get a sense of scale. So how many of properties do you know? How many properties were just on the registry on this?
Oh, on the registry.
Catalog of lesser historic properties.
I don't recall, but it's thousands. Mm-hmm. And people can go to, there's the Oregon Parks Department mm-hmm. is sort of in charge of this. There's, you can go to their website. It's the Oregon Parks Department. They have a heritage database. Mm-hmm. There's also a map. And part of what I'm doing in my mapping project that we'll talk about later too is to map the historic. I'm not doing the mapping, but to provide mm-hmm. that as a layer mm-hmm. of all of the properties just in Portland that are on the HRI. There's thousands.
And did you have a sense of how many properties were demolished between the time that they uncoupled and recoupled this sort of list, this public notice process?
Well, part of the problem, even when I was doing my study, is that delisting was an administrative process up until then. So it wasn't, all we could do is say this was on the database, but there was no public notification. So there wasn't a database that said this got delisted on this date or this date. So I got a photocopy of a photocopied extract from a spreadsheet that only went back so far. So I wasn't able to actually get my arms around everything that had been. Sure. That's why I only went back 5 years. Mm-hmm. What we found, and I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. I tend to sort of to archive some of those things when I'm done with it. But in terms of the larger question, how many HRI properties are out there? When you look at the map, you can see, especially in working class, in these working class neighborhoods, especially close in along, you know, what used to be streetcar lines, they're everywhere and they're disappearing.
And so your feeling is that one way to prevent, you know, demolitions, or at least to prevent demolitions and the dislocation that they create, and to give the public more input and influence on how their community is shaped by private investment, to create a more of a dialogue between the community and private investment, is by creating stronger historic preservation zones or designations, or to bring historic preservation in as an element that can bridge these two forces.
I think that there's actually something that's a lot more streamlined that doesn't have to be historic preservation with a capital H. That still has its place and time. But if we're talking about as a tool for gentrification, if we're talking about, so for instance, in historic districts, they get subject to demolition review, but getting a historic district, because of what I mentioned earlier, owner consent, there are no regulatory tools in between federal designation as a historic district or a historic landmark that even subject anything to a basic demolition review that says
you cannot from the outside classify someone's home as historic if they don't want to.
Exactly.
Can you do it at the federal level?
So in Oregon, we have owner consent.
So even the federal government cannot declare an area historic unless everyone in that area agrees to be.
Yeah. And that makes Oregon unique in the union. And that's why when you travel around the United States to other historic cities, the fabric looks a lot different because there is a balance.
Like Charleston or Boston or places with a lot of historic districts. Yeah.
There's a balance between preservation and project and progress, and between public and private interest.
Now we see historic districts in Portland all the time. We see the little sign caps. I'm using the royal we, but I'm sure people have noticed people rebrand themselves as historic, historic Mississippi, historic Irvington.
Right.
What is that? What is that? Is that not a historic district? Is that not preserved?
Sure. I mean, so one of the historic districts in Portland that I adore is the Alphabet District. And this is, I think, a good example of historic districts that have a lot of diversity kind of built in. And Irvington is a bit of a different look and feel. But mind you, those historic districts, some historic districts were formed without all of the vitriol that is happening now, because they weren't necessarily about trying to form historic districts in the midst of a speculative real estate gold rush and in the midst of an affordable housing crisis. And so
those areas are protected, though?
Yeah, Irvington is a historic district.
Is that a federal historic district?
Yes, a national historic district. And part of what that does, the only thing that means is that if a developer wants to demolish something aside from certain things that have to do with certain aesthetics, but really in terms of this conversation, what that means is that if a developer wants to demolish, it's subject to review. It doesn't mean that it's protected. It really doesn't. What it means is that it's subject to a review, and a case has to be made, and the public gets to know about it, and the public gets to talk about it. Everywhere else in the city, so in Portland, historic districts are 3%. But everywhere else,
3% of the city. 3%
of the city. Yeah. Yeah.
Federal historic, national.
Yeah. But if we're talking sort of not just in terms of Portland, but if we're talking about preservation as a tool to sort of mitigate displacement and gentrification, at the very least, one of those things that historic districts get that the rest of the city doesn't is this common sense review that says, well, is it sound and is it habitable? Well, why do you, if you want to tear something down that's sound and habitable, how does the community benefit from that?
So what do you see the role of historic, the streamlined role of historic preservation in the fight for affordable housing?
I see some very practical, and again, if we can talk, we can talk about historic with a capital H, or we can just talk about preservation in the same way that we talk about recycling, in the same way that we talk about fixing stuff that's broke. Mm-hmm. And most things are not so broken that they can't be fixed. And we sort of have a responsibility, I think, environmentally and socially. And so we can take some of those tools from historic preservation. So with a large H, one of the things that historic preservation, historic designation can do is combine a historic tax credit with a low-income housing tax credit to raise funds to create deeply, deeply affordable housing. So we see there are a lot of places in Portland and elsewhere around the country where this has happened. So for instance, in San Francisco, there's a YMCA in the Tenderloin that the YMCA said, we can't afford to do the seismic retrofits. Mm-hmm. And that was on the National Registry, which meant that they could take historic tax credits and low-income housing tax credits and combine a bunch of other financing to provide, I don't remember how many units in there, but it's not only is it in the heart of the city, it's dignified, it's solid, it's beautiful, and it's large, and it already exists. The cost of new construction is prohibitively expensive. So that's one way that—
So to incentivize preservation financially through tax credit. I'm assuming an overlay, basically you would say this area is, or this building is eligible for tax credits because it's an older established building.
Yeah. And so you can, I mean, they've done that in Portland with the Fritz Erickson apartments and a bunch of others that some people aren't even aware of. And so historic preservation in terms of providing deeply subsidized low income housing, that's a fast track that already exists. You don't have to break new ground. You don't have to, you can adapt and reuse what's already there. And we're not talking about encasing anything in amber. Also, we're talking about preservation, where I think we can have some common sense tools that don't call for this sort of discretionary review that says, well, is this historic or is it not? What does historic mean? I was talking about that demolition review. Mm-hmm. So just demolition review that says, if you're going to demolish sound and habitable housing, then it must meet strict exception criteria tethered to affordability and needed housing. Needed housing is a lot different than demand.
Tell us about the data map that you've been working on.
Yeah. So there is an initiative here in Portland. We've seen these types of upzoning initiatives elsewhere. Senate Bill 827 in California was sort of an example. In Portland, there is an initiative called the Residential Infill Project that seeks to upzone 96% of the city without any mandates of affordability. And part of what I am doing is to not only sort of take the scant mapping that project has provided, which sort of has a bird's eye view of the city and says, here is the residential infill overlay. And part of, part of the mapping is also to sort of break down false narratives. Anytime I see something that is oversimplified, not cross-referenced, and painted in one broad stroke and one broad color, mm-hmm. it's important to layer that in and say, well, here's the residential infill overlay. Now let's layer that in with looking at the county's multifamily housing inventory. And now let's layer in all of the non-owner occupied single family homes and ADUs. And let's layer in some additional layers that that will allow us to quantify and qualify things like median family income, communities of color, education level, all of these different things that have to do with giving us the truth on the ground that says, what does the data tell us? What's the silent narrative there? Rather than just looking at the narrative that says, everything here is single family zoned, and therefore it is exclusionary, and therefore is keeping out people of lower income, keeping out renters. And that may be the case in certain areas that are where median family income is high and the demographics and all of that sort of perfect storm come together to say, yeah, this could use some diversification. But until we actually can layer and cross-reference those things all together and see it as a whole, the truth isn't being told.
So this shows how changing the zoning might impact existing rental single family houses that are rentals, existing neighborhoods and school districts, and like how the actual impact, or at least you can begin to get a better feeling for what the impact might be on these neighborhoods. And the argument on the one side is that there's too many single family home zones in Portland and that they favor the wealthier, and that if there were more duplexes and triplexes and these smaller zones, it would make Portland more affordable. But so, you're going to have to demolish a lot of single family homes in order to do that, A, is what you're saying, and then B, a lot of those single family homes are affordable rental housing to begin with.
Yeah, and that picture, it's not complicated, but there's sort of more than just one factor. And so, yes, right now, the majority of Portland is zoned single family, which means that places where I live, where there was housing built, you know, in the turn of the century, in the 20s and the 30s and the 50s, all of that diversity is no longer allowed. So in terms of what is the displacement risk when you upzone, you increase the speculative value of the dirt underneath where everybody lives. So not only when I map, I can also, by using these mapping tools, quantify that and say, not only this is how it looks, but how many non-owner occupied single family homes are within that, and where do these other things intersect? And so if we want to talk about truly providing diversity, inclusivity, and affordability through upzoning, then we also have to tether that to things like strong anti-displacement policy, strong tenant protections, affordability mandates, things that allow us to shape development rather than just say, well, we're going to upzone. And we really hope that for-profit development doesn't just throw some gasoline on the fire of gentrification. And one of the members of the Planning and Sustainability Commission said it aptly, Andre Bao. He said, we've seen this movie before.
Right.
And so this, without those strong anti-displacement measures and a demolition threshold in place first, this is... it's one of those things that development likes to call, well, we just don't know. Maybe there will be unintended consequences, but they know, we all know how this story ends. We've seen it over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, I always say New York City has been demolishing things since they first bought the, quote unquote, bought the island, and it just gets more expensive every year.
Yeah, it doesn't create affordability.
Upzoning hasn't made it more affordable. And this is a great podcast to, if you're listening now, to listen to our zoning podcast with Michael Anderson, who is going to take a little bit of the other side of this argument. And he's also going to talk about these same issues. Where can we find this map? This is a very interesting map. It's fascinating. How can people find it?
So It is still in a draft form, but it will be presented in more of a workable form in December when the Planning and Sustainability Commission meets to vote and codify codify this. And I'll be putting up a draft on our new website. I'm forming a new coalition centered around this. Well, I call it C3PR. Kind of like C-3PO, but it's the coalition to prioritize, protect, and preserve affordable housing, C-P-P-P-H.
And is there a website there?
There's a placeholder, but I'll make sure that I get it up after this. But you can also find it if you go to, I'll post it publicly on my Facebook page. I've already sort of done some videos that give a walkthrough of some of the preliminary mapping, but
okay, we'll have a link in our show notes to the map, to your Facebook page.
The mapping is already out there, but I'm going to be preparing an actual report around it so that there's sort of says, here's what this tells us, and here's some other important information.
Well, Meg Nerdletta, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me, Cornelius. I appreciate it.
Welcome back into Priced Out, the podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Morgan, and here with Cornelius Swart. That was a great interview with Meg. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and just so people know, the interview in this podcast is a cut-down version of the raw interview that we live stream on our Facebook page. So if you're hankering for more of what Meg is talking about, you really found that something you want to bite down on, you can always go back into our Facebook page and just see the live recording that we did.
I've never heard the word hankering used outside of like spankering, not being with it. I guess I've never heard hankering.
But you need like hankering for like some moonshine or something like that. Isn't that, do you have to have a giant like sort of Yosemite Sam mustache in order to have a hankering?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Oh man, I threw us off there. All right, so we've got a lot of good shows coming your way in the future. We've got Michelle Lewis coming up.
Yeah, Michelle Lewis is our next interview, and she was featured in Priced Out, the documentary. She talks about where she is today. You know, when we left off with her in the film, she had been displaced out of Northeast Portland, had moved to East Portland, faced some racism out there, some intimidation, a lot of sort of embedded bias against her and her family. And at the end of the film, she moves back into Northeast Portland. So we want to find out how she's doing today. But she also, because she's in mental health, she has a lot of experience with people who have what's called root shock, or the psychological trauma that comes along with losing a community to gentrification. Or say she talks a lot about people who are in jail or prison. They come back several years later and the community is completely gone. And so she's going to talk a lot about the psychological impact of gentrification and displacement.
Well, looking forward to that one, man. That's going to be a good show. I've always liked when we do the panels and Michelle Lewis is there. So that's going to be a really good show. Real quick before we leave, we always talk about comics.
Yeah.
Yesterday, Stan Lee passed away at 95 years old.
Yes. And so a giant.
I was at the comic book shop shooting for my documentary about black comic books, and people were walking in and out the shop. Like, guys literally came in and was asking for hugs, you know.
Wow.
Like it was like that. One guy did say something I thought was hilarious. He said, I wonder if he's gonna make an appearance in his funeral.
And I was like, he's gonna like pop in as a cameo and say Excelsior.
Maybe. So but yeah, that's the joke. That was a joke I heard yesterday. I was like, and it's not too soon.
Yeah.
Sometimes when people die, you're like, oh, too soon. I saw a couple of memes where they did the Thanos disappearing thing, and it was like, I guess it's not too soon. He would enjoy these jokes.
The guy was in it until he was 95. He essentially never retired. I mean, and he always looked like he was having fun.
Yes.
You know, you can joke about it because the guy lived his life so, at least it seemed like the guy lived his life so well. It's like, well, man, what a great run. I mean, you got to say, what a great run. So if you have a joke there, as long as it's not mean-spirited.
Right.
Right? It doesn't seem like an insult because his passing, I don't think there's as much mourning about his passing than just like, what is the old expression? Don't mourn that he's gone, just celebrate that he was there.
Yeah.
That seems like that's the natural way
yeah.
to think about Stan. Like, you're not like, oh, man, I can't believe he's not around anymore. It's like, 95. Man, I can't believe he was around for so long. We had him yeah. for so long.
95 years. Yeah. That's a long time. The average person isn't really making it past 75, 80 anymore. I don't know what the real average is. I'm just saying. But yeah.
And still to be kicking it in Marvel movies, yeah. to still be involved in the Marvel universe. I mean, he's the biggest name in comic books, right? I can't yeah. think of a single other person
no.
who is so... like the icon of
who's known to the masses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. He's it. That's what it is. That's what you want to be. For me, that's what it is when you say I'm living my dreams. You want to be able to die still attached to what you do.
Yeah.
There was no retirement. There was just until the day you die. There's going to be a movie that's going to come out and he's going to be in it.
Right.
You know,
right.
you know he's going to make an appearance in those Avengers movies that were shot before he passed away. Right.
The second coming. The second yeah. and third coming.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing his cameo in Captain Marvel mm-hmm. and in the Avengers 4, because it's going to happen.
Yep. He lives on.
Yep.
Enough said.
Share, like, and make sure you check for us everywhere you can find all of your favorite podcasts. We're on Spotify, iTunes.
Stitcher.
Pocket Cast. Just so many. So if you're out there looking for podcasts, you will find Priced Out the Podcast. Make sure you share it with a friend. Today. Share.
Thank you, and you will hear from us again.